The new book, Blue Mind, by today's guest, Wallace Nichols, asks, how should we understand our connection to water? Water has been not only a necessity for survival of the species on Earth, but also a source of personal pleasure, recreation, and relaxation, but we hardly pay attention to water's physiological and neurological impacts until now. The book's foreword is written by Céline Cousteau, the granddaughter of the prominent French biologist and oceanographer Jacques Cousteau. She writes that we are beginning to learn that our brains are hardwired to react positively to water, and that being near it can calm and connect us, increase innovation and insight, and even heal what's broken. So how should we understand our deep and pervasive relationship with water? In Blue Mind, Wallace Nichols aims to change the way we feel, think, and interact with water. He writes, quote, water is both lover and mother, murderer and life giver, source and sink. Water unleashes the uninhibited child in all of us, unlocking our creativity and curiosity, end quote. Wallace Nichols is a research associate at the California Academy of Sciences and founder and co-director of Ocean Revolution, See the Wild, and Live Blue. He has spent his adult life working for the ocean. His new book is Blue Mind, the surprising science that shows how being near, in, on, or underwater can make you happier, healthier, more connected, and better at what you do. And Wallace joins me here in studio. Hi. Hi, thank you for coming in.
Well, thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. So as a water lover who would love to spend every minute of the day snorkeling, I really loved your book. So
thanks.
Thank you so much for writing it. So first off, I love the statistic. Water covers more than 70% of the Earth's surface, but 95% of those waters have yet to be explored. Is the ocean the most unexplored thing we have on Earth today?
Oh yeah, clearly. There's so many places, even just right off of our coast, there are places that no human has ever seen. Just literally right off our coast, let alone 100,000 miles out there. So there's so much out there. There's so much we don't know. There's so many places we haven't been. And as we go, we begin to discover all these amazing new things, these new creatures and the ways they live. And that's fascinating in itself. But what I'm most fascinated about right now is, why are we so fascinated about that fascinating stuff?
Right. Well, and it's interesting because those of us who live here in Northern California are so lucky to be surrounded by the ocean and its beauty. And I'm sure almost all of our listeners probably look at the ocean and feel so much peace. And you write about this in your book, but we don't think about why? Why does this do this to our brains?
Yeah.
And this is fairly new science.
It is new. It's an ancient idea. Mm. It's going way back. People have always known that the ocean, that water gives us all this pleasure. But it's only recently that we have the technology and the tools and perhaps the idea to go a little bit deeper into the science behind that touchy-feely stuff, behind that happiness, behind those emotional connections. And, the science of happiness has kind of had a heyday. Even the science of magic, of how magicians do illusions, there's a whole book on that. And I would go into the bookstores and the libraries and see all these amazing books about the human brain and all these different topics, and I'd flip through them and I'd look for anything about water, and there'd be nothing. Mm. And then I'd go over to the books about water and I'd look for anything about the human brain, about our emotions, about the science of emotion, and there'd be nothing. And so that was kind of a hobby for a while, just going, finding these new books and going through the index, reading the books, scanning them, and trying to find that connection. And then finally I said, well, that's the book I want to write, the one that connects water and our brain, our emotions. And so literally dove into the process. Actually, I tried really hard to give this project away to people who perhaps were smarter and better prepared. And I got no takers. And so decided I'd just do it.
Well, it must have been a great journey for you, because you write that over the past several years, you've brought together an eclectic group of scientists, psychologists, educators, explorers, artists, researchers, to consider a fundamental question. What happens when our most complex organ, the brain, meets the planet's largest feature, the water?
Yeah, simple question,
yeah.
Right? I mean, what happens? And You know, the interesting thing about that is I get folks on the phone, these eminent neuroscientists and psychologists, and I'd say, here's what we're doing. We're having this conference. We call it Blue Mind. I'd love for you to come and talk about, you know, our brain on water. And there'd be this quiet, and they'd say, wow, that's really, really interesting. And then they'd say, I think you've got the wrong person. I don't study the brain on water. And I'd say, yes, it is interesting, and no, you're the right person. And nobody really studies the brain on water, which is why we're doing this. We want to generate some interesting questions and start to connect the dots and find the answers.
You also write that we are now at the forefront of a wave of neuroscience, evolutionary biology, and medical research that illuminates the physiological and brain processes that underlie our transformative connection to water. So can you talk a little bit about why has it taken so long to start to get this information, for neuroscientists to really focus on this connection?
Yeah, it's really been the last, I'd say, 20 years that neuroscientists have had the capabilities and the technologies to, you know, as they say, open the box and look inside and really ask questions about a living brain, to put people into different situations and see how our brains respond. And, you know, some call this the golden age of neuroscience, and investments are being made. Research is taking place. Your brain on music is a popular topic. 20 years ago, that was, you know, sort of fringe, maybe a sort of a Californian idea. Your brain on stress. Well, every medical doctor now understands that stress changes our brains, changes our physiology, and is implicated in many diseases. 20, 25, 30 years ago, that was a fringe idea. So as we're opening the box, looking inside, looking at our brains and understanding how they work, we're able to ask a whole bunch of new questions. And, you know, I would have thought your brain on water would be maybe one of the first questions. It turns out to be kind of lower on the list, but here we are discussing it. So
doing this research over the past few years, what was most surprising to you? What did you learn?
I think the most surprising things are some of the most obvious things. So, you know, you step out of the city, you step out of your car up to the water, onto the beach, and you just get this feeling. I mean, maybe you've come a long way. Maybe you really, really needed that break. Maybe it's a vacation. Maybe it's just the end of the day. Maybe you're with someone you love. But you get there and you feel this, you know, your breathing slows, your heart rate slows, the quality of your thought changes. And what I think is most surprising is that we haven't really studied that.
Hmm.
That's the most surprising thing, not what we've found, but that we haven't really studied that rigorously. It's such an important part of, you know, society, really. And it's free. Here in California, we all own the coast.
Mm-hmm.
We all own the coast. We are all rich with coast. And you can go there whenever you want and have this feeling. And we don't talk about it that way. And so that's probably the most surprising thing, is that these dots really haven't been thoroughly connected. And I think about all the work many of our friends and colleagues do to get kids out of the cities, out of the schools, out to the ocean, out to the water, into the tide pools. And I think, wow, there's so much potential there to also explain to these same kids not just what a limpet is and what a limpet eats and how the tides work, but also explain how their own brain is now responding to being at the beach, and remind them that they can come to that spot anytime they want for the rest of their lives. Mm. And it may be just the thing they need to just keep out of trouble, or stay in school, or stay in a job, or it may be just the thing that a relationship needs to be cemented together.
You reminded me of a documentary we featured when we did a show about the Ocean Film Festival, a short documentary called The Sunnydale Kids, which is the story of inner city kids in San Francisco and the healing power that a day at the ocean with some surfboards can provide. I mean, these kids live about 5 minutes from our studio, never been to Ocean Beach. Or they went to Muir Beach, actually. Yeah. And they were taken to Muir Beach with surfboards. They got a quick lesson, and they were surfing. Yeah. And the faces are amazing. I mean, these kids are dealing with gunshots, just horrific problems, massive poverty, taken out to the beach, and it's like a completely different world for them. And related to that, I love the story you tell about the Tohono O'odham, which means desert people. They're Native Americans who reside primarily in the Sonoran Desert of southeastern Arizona and Northwest University. And when you were a grad student at the University of Arizona, you used to take teen kids from the Tohono O'odham Nation across the border to the Sea of Cortez.
That's right.
Can you tell us? I love this story.
Yeah, so yeah, I was, you know, this is a surprising thing. I did my PhD in Tucson, Arizona at the University of Arizona, and I studied the ocean, but the ocean that I studied was in Mexico. So we'd cross the border and do our field work and do our educational work. And a friend who was working on the reservation said, you know, a lot of these kids have never seen the ocean, but their culture has this deep linkage to the ocean. They used to make pilgrimages to the ocean and bring back salt and bring back shells and all kinds of other ocean stuff. But these kids have never done that and never seen the ocean. So we put together this plan to take kids to the ocean. And so we get there and I said, okay, everybody get your shorts and put your shorts on. And look, everybody's looking around like, oh, we don't have shorts. You know, they're sort of like kids, you know, chinos, low riding chinos kind of sagging. And I said, all right, well then we're going to cut our pants off. So I got out a pocket knife and we cut the legs off of our pants and made shorts. And so we all did it. So everybody felt good about that. And then we get in the water and pass out the masks and snorkels. And I remember this one kid, you know, comes up. I said, so what do you think? What'd you see? I can't see anything. And I said, well, go back under and look around. He went back under, came back up. And then I realized that I had to tell him, you got to open your eyes. You can open your eyes underwater. That's what the mask is for. And so he went back under and then just came exploding up to the surface and couldn't believe what it was like underwater. And then he was gone for hours, just exploring his world, his ocean, and himself really is what he was doing. And that night, you know, it was just a happy group of people and stories to tell and a love of our planet, really, that was grown and expanded just by getting wet.
You write that he was laughing and crying at the same time and shouted, my planet is beautiful.
He did, yeah.
I love this story. What is it about snorkeling and diving? I mean, because snorkeling is one of my favorite things. I'm so content and feel so much peace when I'm under the water. Like, I almost feel like a visitor. Like, I put my hands sort of behind my back and just watch these fish, the occasional octopus, maybe a shark if I'm lucky. And it's such an amazing experience. What is it about that?
Well, it's, you know, the barrier to entry is pretty low. So you can acquire snorkeling skills fairly quickly. So a mask and a snorkel. And as soon as you relax enough to do it, you're in. And then you get in the water and the sound of your world changes. You know, all the noise, the traffic, the chatter, the voices, the conversations, the TV, the radio, gone. So number one, it's quiet. It's your own thoughts. It's the sound of the water. Visually, things shift. So now the busyness of, you know, the world around us, you know, the signs and the faces and all the distractions gone. So now visually it's simplified. And then you're buoyant. If you're in salt water, you know, you're being supported and the water is touching all of your body. So you have this sort of feeling of being supported. So from a sensory point of view, everything changes. And for the most part, the shift is towards a different kind of stimulation, but one that allows you to have a more relaxed or a more self-referential kind of thinking. And for a lot of people, that's the maybe the first time in a long time that they've been able to go there. Their busy lives are just really don't give them that opportunity. And so you literally unplugged and you've walked down to the water and you've gotten in, and now you're really alone with your thoughts. Mm. And there's so much to look around and see that keeps you there. So, you know, psychologists call it soft fascination. So it's interesting enough, but not overwhelmingly distracting. And so it holds your attention. It holds you in that relaxed place and that relaxed state of mind. It's interesting enough to keep you there. And so when you put your face in the water, your breathing and your heart rate slows. That's a mammalian response to water. So now your heart rate is slowing. I mean, unless, of course, you know, you're kicking against a hard current or being chased by a shark or something like that. But generally speaking, when you're snorkeling, you're relaxed. Mm. And your hands are behind your back. You're kicking along. You're looking around. You're diving down. And your heart rate and your breathing rate are slowing. And you're having a different quality of thought. So all of that together makes up blue mind. And it begins the moment you see the water. And you move towards it. And then the moment you touch the water, it's enhanced. And then as you get pulled in and continue to spend your day snorkeling, you get your blue mind on. And then when you get out, you have this sort of sense of euphoria, right? You're kind of relaxed, a bit tired, but sometimes in a position to make some really important decisions. Mm. And there's some kind of interesting anecdotes about people who have made really important decisions while in the water snorkeling that laid out, you know, big chunks of their lives.
I'm speaking with Wallace Nichols. He's a research associate at the California Academy of Sciences and founder and co-director of Ocean Revolution. He's out with a new book called Blue Mind, The Surprising Science That Shows How Being Near, In, On, or Underwater Can Make You Happier, Healthier, More Connected, and Better at What You Do. And this is a pre-taped conversation, so unfortunately we cannot take any of your phone calls, but I'd love to have you back because I'm sure listeners have so many stories about how they're affected by water. Since we're talking about snorkeling, talk a little bit about how different kinds of water activities have varying physiological and neurological impacts. So, you know, diving and snorkeling versus swimming and surfing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, really this book is about everything from the glass of water here in front of me mm-hmm. to the great, big, huge Pacific Ocean that's right out our door, and everything in between. So when we talk about water, this is not just an ocean conversation. It's about all of this water. So if you're looking for a way to bring more blue mind into your life, it isn't just about saving up for a tropical vacation, although it is that too.
Because most people, like the overwhelming majority of Americans, have never been underwater, right?
Yeah. Well, most people, when they go to the ocean, they look at it and they walk on the beach. That's the number one activity. A small percentage of people actually get in or on the water, whether it's swimming or boating. And an even smaller percentage go deep under the water and dive down more than a few feet. So most people are on the edge of the water. A few people are in the top, say, 3 feet of the water. Very, very few go further out and further under. So this conversation for most people is one of the edge of the water. And it's also about urban waterways. So we have water in our cities. We have fountains. We have rivers. We have ponds and lakes. And they play an incredibly important role in so the day-to-day relaxation and the psychological well-being of urban people.
Talk a little bit about the benefits of seeing the water. Why is it that we have that sort of calm feeling when we see the water? Or, I mean, I live about a bike ride to the beach. And if I do an intense show, which is fairly frequently, I always think about, oh, I can't wait to ride my bike to the beach. It just even makes my shoulders kind of go down. Mm-hmm. Why is that?
It's the contrast between red mind, what I call red mind, and blue mind. And when your cortisol level, your stress hormones are up, mm-hmm. Which is normal our normal response to stimulation or tasks that are urgent or loud noises or deadlines is to increase our stress and get the job done. Unfortunately, a lot of us live that way from the moment we wake up to the moment we go to sleep. Our devices are always at hand. They're always screaming at us that something needs to be done or looked at. And we never quite get out of that red mind mode. All right, so, but red mind is important. It gets us out of trouble. It helps us get things done. But if we're in red mind all the time, things start to break down. Our body starts to deteriorate. We have what's called toxic stress, and that is bad for us on every level. And that's implicated in 60% of the diseases that, that people deal with. So stress kills, stress makes us sick. Contrast that to blue mind is that that moment when you can escape from red mind. And that may mean just popping in the shower, a short shower because we're conserving water. It may mean sharing a bath. It may mean getting on your bike and riding down to the beach and taking a little walk. And it may mean going into the water. It may mean a walk across the Golden Gate Bridge and just stopping in the middle and looking out and being in awe. So what happens then is your all that stimulation is peeled away. All that those different senses are less stimulated. And your brain still wants to be active, so it switches into a very different mode. Like I said before, your heart rate slows, your breathing rate slows, but your brain mode switches to something that neuroscientists refer to as the default mode network, which is a whole different set of brain regions that is much more creative, much more oriented towards self-referential thinking. And after some time being awed by the water, by the Pacific Ocean, right after that, researchers find that you're more empathetic.
Hmm.
Your empathy goes up. Your compassion goes up. Your willingness to act outside of yourself. So what seems to be going on is you break free of the me, now scenario, red mind. You get your blue mind on. And it may be a forest. It may be a stream. It may be a lake. Maybe the Pacific. You have this experience that is self-referential in a sense, but it has that feeling of oneness. And not to get all kind of California groovy, but this is what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what pulls us towards it. And then you come away from that and you're in a different state of mind. And it's one that's much more likely to help somebody out. Maybe much more likely to join a Protect the Ocean effort. So connecting all these dots has been really interesting, and bringing, you know, the psychologists and neuroscientists and cognitive scientists to the table and saying, what's going on here? And then letting them kind of riff on it, and then taking those ideas back into the lab and saying, okay, let's put some science behind this.
I'm speaking today with Wallace Nichols, a research associate at the California Academy of Sciences and founder, co-director of Ocean Revolution. He is out with a new book called Blue Mind, The Surprising Science That Shows How Being Near, In, On, or Underwater Can Make You Happier, Healthier, More Connected, and Better at What You Do. And in the book, he asks, why are humans so enthralled by water? And why is this question so obvious and important, yet so hard to adequately answer? This is a pre-tape show, so unfortunately we cannot take your calls, but we will be right back after this.
This is your call on local public radio, KALW, San Francisco. Time is 10:30. Coming up at 11, the BBC's World Have Your Say. And at noon today, Ira Glass and This American Life. This week, Mind Your Own Business.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, I'm speaking with Wallace Nichols. He is Research Associate at the California Academy of Sciences and author of the new book, Blue Mind, The Surprising Science That Shows How Being Near, In, On, or Underwater Can Make You Happier, Healthier, More Connected, and Better at What You Do. He takes a look at how we should understand our deep and pervasive relationship with water. Why are we so enthralled by it? And why is this question so obvious? It seems so obvious to so many of us who love water and the ocean, yet it's so hard to adequately answer. Before the break, you were talking about all of the benefits we get, whether it's taking a shower, walking over the Golden Gate Bridge, going to the ocean, going under, being underwater. What would you say to the people who are close to water but don't take advantage of it? Because I've got friends who live, you know, in the Mission District who never go to the beach, ever. And yeah, it's a half hour to get there, but it's kind of surprising to me because I go so often. So what would you say to people who don't really interact with water that much but have access to it?
Yeah, I would say, you know, that's one of the objectives of this book is to inspire people. So you get to the end of the book and you say, oh, man, this makes me want to go to the water.
Yeah.
And the message that I hope people get is, yes, do that and take somebody with you. You have two hands, grab two people by the hand and take them with you. Take people who haven't been to the water lately. Take some kids who have never seen the ocean. Walk down to the end of your road and take some people to the pond that you pass by every day and you never stop and check out. Jump in it. If you can't jump in it, find out why you can't jump in it and break down those barriers. Maybe it's not clean enough. Well, clean it up. Maybe it's not accessible because the gate is locked. Well, get that gate open. Maybe it's not public. Well, figure that out. And so break down the what I call blue mind blockers and get to the water. So that's really what it's about. If we all take somebody with us every time we go to the beach, every time we go to the lake or the river, or even for a swim in a pool, then all of a sudden we're going to build the number of people who are falling in love with water, and hopefully the number of water advocates.
You also write about the fact that so much of this is innate. And you cite Edward O. Wilson, a Harvard University biologist, naturalist, and entomologist, who in 1984 coined the term biophilia to describe his hypothesis that humans have ingrained in our genes an instinctive bond with nature and the living organisms we share with the planet. He theorized that because we've spent most of our evolutionary history, 3 million years and 100,000 generations or more in nature, we have an innate love of natural settings. And there's a dialogue going on right now, and I really hope it continues because I think it's so important, about nature deficiency and how, because of technology, a lot of kids are not playing outside like they used to. We're not spending as much time as we used to outside. So you're advocating that we spend more time by water, in water, feeling water, and yet we're dealing with this sort of technology that's taking us away from the outdoors.
Right. And that's, you know, that's an interesting conversation about, you know, this technology that is taking up our time in ways that just being outside used to. And it's trapping us inside. And even beyond that, I see kids who do go to the beach, but they've got their iPad or their iPhone with them. And what does that do? Well, they've got their apps open. They've got their games open. They're sitting on the beach. So being on the beach is good, but their eyes are still on their device. And then when it's time to go in the water, they don't want to go in the water because they would have to leave their device on the beach and somebody might steal it. So by being tethered to these devices, it keeps us out of the water in, you know, many ways. It keeps our perception oriented away from the water, but it keeps us physically out of the water because we don't want to get our iPads or iPods or our iPhones wet. And I guess what I'm not advocating for waterproof cases like the one I have right here necessarily. I'm just saying leave it at home,
right,
and break free.
Well, and so what is that doing to our brains? Because when I go on vacation, I love to look at how people interact with the ocean. And I noticed that in, like, on a Hawaiian vacation, sometimes people have their chairs facing the hotel, not the ocean. And I want to say, turn around. The ocean is right behind you. Why are you looking at the hotel? What is it in the brain that's doing that?
Yeah, you know, there's a fascinating and disturbing study that just came out this week of people's ability to do solitude, to sit quietly. And they looked at a range of people, a range of ages, and in a range of settings. And most people couldn't sit quietly for 15 minutes. And in fact, it was so painful to sit quietly for them that they preferred to shock themselves over sitting quietly.
Wow.
And there's one guy who shocked himself over that 15-minute period 190 times.
In 15
Yeah,
minutes?
they actually threw that data out because it was such an outlier. But 67% of men were unable to sit for 15 minutes without shocking themselves, just because they were bored. And so the options were sit quietly or shock yourself. And so being quiet for 15 minutes was more painful than the shock. So that suggests that we are becoming habituated to just being stimulated all the time. If there's too much quiet, we make a noise. If there's too much calm, we figure out a way to shock ourselves. We turn on the radio, we turn on the TV, we pick up the phone and check our email. And you might say, well, that's very productive, and that's an adaptation to our modern lives. But we are losing something in that. The ability to sit quietly and think deeply about yourself, about the world around you, about other people, is incredibly important for creativity, for innovation, for problem solving. And that is slowly being lost. And so I think it may be an antidote to that inability to find solitude could be water. And I think that soft fascination that happens when you're by the water, that it does hold your attention. It is interesting, but it isn't overstimulating. And so for people who feel like they need some more of that quiet downtime, maybe water is one way to do it that isn't as painful as just sitting quietly with your own thoughts. And it's kind of, you know, I say in the book that water meditates you. You don't need to learn meditation. You don't need to go to the class. You don't need to read a book. You just need to go to the edge of the water and stand there and look at it and listen to it. And it will help you do that work. And it will put you into this, you know, blue mind state that is, it's worth doing. It's worth doing.
How are scientists doing this kind of work? I mean, when they think about why we feel so peaceful and in this meditative state when we go to the ocean, how are they studying that?
There's a, you know, a range of techniques and technologies that researchers use to study, say, your brain on nature, your brain on water. First, and probably the simplest, they ask you, how do you feel? Come over here, stand here, do this. Okay, how do you feel now? And write that down. And maybe, you know, you've probably been the subject of some of these kinds of questions. On a scale of 1 to 10, answer this question, answer this question, answer this. And then so now you've got some numbers to work with. And if you do enough question asking with enough different people in different situations, you may find some patterns that emerge. You use statistics, and then you tell a story about that. That's the way a lot of this work has been done traditionally, but it's problematic because you're assuming people actually know how they feel. And it turns out we don't always even know how we feel. We don't really know how to express that feeling, especially if I say, you know, from on a scale of 1 to 10, tell me how that ocean feels to you. You know, how relaxed are you? And it's pretty hard for a lot of people to translate how they're feeling to, you know, a number. So you get, you know, self-reporting can be notoriously off, but it's useful. Then you can kind of nudge things a bit and say, okay, well, answer those questions and please spit in this tube and I'm going to look at your stress hormones in your saliva. I can also measure your heart rate very easily. The device is available to do that unobtrusively in the field, really anywhere. People have devices probably maybe even in their pockets right now. Your phone, your smartphone can be synced to those. People are measuring their heart rates while they're running on trails and roads, while they're biking. So that technology is very simple. We can look at heart rate. We can look at skin temperature. We can look at breathing rate and see how people respond to nature. Then it starts to get a little more complicated. You get into measuring people's brains actually using EEG or fMRI technologies where you can put a swim cap with a whole bunch of sensors on it that measure the electricity of the brain. And then you can filter out all the noise, because there's a lot of noise. The muscle movement of your face, the muscle movement of your head sends electrical signals that are not brain signals, so that complicates things. But you filter out that data and you analyze it back in the lab, and you can tell some things about what's going on with people's brains. Then even further and more expensive along the scale, you can put people into a big giant magnet and look at brain activity. In fact, you're really looking at oxygen levels in the brain, which is a proxy for brain activity. And so from extremely inexpensive and easy to do to very expensive, a lot harder to do, you've got this range of techniques and technologies that are now allowing us to ask simple questions and hard questions. Simple questions like, how does the water make you feel?
Right. And so based on the data, we know that being by water makes us healthier, happier, reduces stress, and brings us peace.
Yeah. And it's, I think what's clear when you read the book is you want more. You're going, okay, I want more research. I do too.
Yeah.
I've had to dig and dig and connect and cajole and inquire. And what we've ended up with is, a bunch of dots that are connecting, a bunch of new research that's underway right now. It's really exciting. Some of it I hint at in the book, but isn't published yet. And I can't wait until it is. And a whole bunch of people who are signing up to study this, who are saying, wow, I love water, I love the ocean, and I'm interested in people. I want to connect some dots here. Give me some questions that will become my PhD dissertation, and where should I go study this, and how can I do this? And so we're right at the beginning, and it's an exciting place to be. I think that the take-home message that you'll get from the book is, wow, let's do more. Let's go deeper.
And spend more time near water.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
In water and underwater.
Yep.
I'm speaking today with Wallace Nichols, a research associate at the California Academy of Sciences. His new book is called Blue Mind, The Surprising Science That Shows How Being Near, In, On, or Underwater Can Make You Happier, Healthier, More Connected, and Better at What You Do. You've got some interesting research in here, too, about how many of us actually live near the water. A lot of us live near water.
Yeah, a lot and increasing. There used to be all kinds of reasons for putting cities and towns along the waterways, because that's how we got around. The rivers and the coast were essentially our highways. That's less the case now. People don't move goods and themselves as often along waterways, but that's where our towns and cities largely remain, and we're attracted to the coast. I mean, people, I meet people all the time. Their dream is to retire near water in some shape or form, and sometimes that shape or form is frozen, so they want to retire near a big snowy mountain, and sometimes it's a lake, and sometimes it's a river, an ocean. But that's the dream of a lot of people, is to be by the water.
80% of the world's population lives within 60 miles of the coastline of an ocean, lake, or river. That's a lot.
That's a lot. And I think the key point there is that puts a lot of pressure on our coast, and it puts a lot of pressure on our waters. Mm-hmm. And we need to figure out how to do that better. And really, that's the underlying idea of the book, is if we don't measure these cognitive, emotional, psychological, and social benefits and services that the water's providing, if we don't talk about them, if we don't name them, and then they don't show up in our policy. They don't show up in our reports, and they don't show up in the balance sheet. When they don't show up in the balance sheet, we undervalue water drastically. So when you think, well, how much stress does walking by the water remove from the community? Well, good question. We don't really have the answer. But it does remove some stress. I know down in Santa Cruz, people who go to the beach every day, and it sucks the stress out of them, whether they surf or not. And then their next interaction with their family, with their coworkers, is better quality, right? So let's just take all that stress that the water has pulled out of the community and put it back into the community. What happens? Well, what happens when you add stress to a community? It's usually not good things,
right?
It's disease, it's conflict, it's arguments, it's probably less creativity. So what's that worth? Good question. Something. I don't know what the number is, but it's worth something. Let's name it. Let's talk about it. Let's make sure it's in there. Because when we lose access to the water, we lose all of those benefits as well.
Well, and in order to continue to derive all of these benefits, we need a healthy ocean. We need healthy lakes and rivers and streams.
Yep.
So I wonder, while I was reading your book, and I'd love to find out later in the show, just, you know, what is it about water that inspires you, and why are you so inspired by nature? But first, how do you convey this to the public at a time when we're hearing about ocean acidification? Most people don't know what that means. Our coral reefs are in such trouble, so much trouble, but if you're not under the water, you're not seeing it. Mm-hmm. And I often think, I kind of wish that the ocean was able to turn colors based on its health. So when we go to the ocean, it's beautiful regardless of the amount of trash, regardless of the amount of, the coral turning brown. And I thought, well, what if the water turned red when it was in trouble? How would the public respond to that, right? But if you don't go in it, you can't see that it's in trouble. So how do you think we should convey these issues to the public without overwhelming them?
Yeah, that's a key thing. So if you keep telling people bad news about the ocean, and that the ocean is sick, the ocean is sad, the ocean is dirty, the ocean is polluted, the ocean is becoming more acidic, the ocean is dead, then pretty soon they're just not going to want to talk to you. They're not going to want to think about the ocean. And the conversation is not really going to get where you're hoping you were going by sharing all this scary news. I'm not saying bury it. I'm a scientist. I study all this bad news all the time, and I read it every day. But if you're trying to motivate people, I find that starting at that point where, what's your favorite water? What's your favorite part of the ocean? Where do you go? Just tell me about it. How does it make you feel? And then listen. And then talk about what would it be like if you couldn't do that, or if you hadn't done that. How would your life be different? And really get at those cognitive, emotional, personal benefits that people assign to going to the ocean. And I think that's a better starting point and a better frame than just coming out with, the ocean is sick and dead and is gonna be gone. Mm. That freaks people out. Another thing we do a lot is we take kids for their first experience at the ocean to do a beach cleanup. So their first experience with this amazing place, the ocean, is cleaning up somebody else's trash. It's nasty. You put gloves on. You wouldn't believe what you find. It's really pretty gross.
Yeah.
And it seems kind of unjust. So it's disgusting and it's unjust. It's definitely not fun. You can try to make trash fun, but generally speaking, for a kid it's not so much fun. Plus, our kids are cleaning up all this adult trash. That's not so cool. And so what we may be doing is teaching a whole generation of kids that the ocean equals trash. And that's their first experience. So I would say the key thing is to understand that there are measurable, real, cognitive and emotional benefits that come from the ocean. Enhance those, talk about them, build them, have kids fall in love with how they feel when they're in, on, near water, and start from there. And that's the base. And if you ask people who spend their lives fighting to clean up water, why? You almost always come back to some really deep, beautiful story, whether it's Paul Watson or Sylvia Earle, or my own childhood. I'm here talking to you because of these amazing experiences playing in water. And I decided I wanted to be a marine biologist. And then I did it. So, but it all comes back to that wonder, that awe, that play, that fun, and builds on that.
What are your thoughts on policy changes? Because I love the idea behind your book and just why we love water, what it does to us. It brings our stress levels down. But would you agree that the fact is we need the ocean to be protected and we need strong laws? So the State Department recently held a conference in D.C. with people from around the world focused on protecting our ocean. A lot of really great announcements came out from that about marine protected areas. What would you, like the top two policy changes, what would you want to see?
You know, I think a lot of what's going on is very positive, and that conference had a lot of great outcomes, and it's very focused on economics, so protecting jobs, protecting our economy, and biodiversity, protecting the diversity of life along our coastlines. One of my degrees is in economics, my other degree is in biology, biodiversity. So yes, and let's also talk about the human benefits that are also derived from protecting our waters. And probably the best way to explain that is through a story of this guy, Bobby Lane, that I met, who's from Texas, who fought in Afghanistan and returned and had several traumatic brain injuries that just messed him up. He was not really able to function, didn't want to live any longer. Came out to Santa Cruz, got in the ocean, got on a surfboard, third try, caught a wave, and decided, I want to live. And I want to live and help people feel like this. Slept for the first time in a long time. Actually slept. Sleeping is something we take for granted. Bobby didn't sleep for a very long time until he had that day on the ocean and felt that. Now, that helped Bobby help others. But you know what Bobby wants to do now? He wants to fight for the ocean. He wants to fight for the ocean. You know why? Because the ocean saved his life, right? So that's a different kind of conversation than we've been having, environmentalists versus developers. That's a shift, and it's kind of an uncomfortable shift, but it's a shift. And it says that, you know, we all should be fighting for the ocean. We all should be fighting for our lakes and our rivers, because they give us not just biodiversity, not just jobs. It's not just about economics. It's about creativity and well-being. It's about romance. It's about falling in love. It's about, that's the place where people go to tell each other they love each other, to pledge their love, to celebrate it, to honeymoon, to all of those. And even at the end of life, to say goodbye. Please cast my ashes over the water when I'm done. That's what it's about, right? And so from a policy point of view, damn, I don't know. How do you turn that into policy? Well, let's talk about it.
Yeah.
But what we usually do is we check that conversation at the door. So my policy recommendation would be to John Kerry, next time he holds that conference, please invite Bobby Lane. Give him the microphone for 15 minutes. Let Bobby tell his story, because it represents the stories of many people, men and women like him, who have fought and been wrecked and are now suffering and not getting the treatment they need. And maybe one way they can do that is being out on the lakes and the rivers and the oceans of our great country.
Wallace Nichols is a research associate at the California Academy of Sciences. His new book is Blue Mind, The Surprising Science That Shows How Being Near, In, On, or Underwater Can Make You Happier, Healthier, More Connected, and Better at What You Do. Check Your Call Radio for more information and information about his book tour. Wallace, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Love
talking about this with you.
Well, I do too, and I hope you can go to the ocean either today or this week. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.
On the next Your Call, which arts organizations serve diverse audiences, and do they get their fair share of public funding? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about a recent report that found that 76% of public grant money in San Francisco goes towards arts programs with primarily white audiences. Yet people of color make up over half the city's population. What's the right way to decide who gets public money for the arts? Do the criteria for arts funding need to change to ensure that the broadest public is served? It's Your Call tomorrow with Hannah Baba and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.